Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Katherine Heigl's Script Reader. I swear to God, I exist. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men.
Shh.
Oh my god.
That pig dancing in the wind.
Oh my god.
It's like it's dancing just for us.
It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in the world.
Welcome to MacGuffin Men.
I'm Alex. And to the left of me.
Drying his tears.
Yeah. Well, I'm crying more now because the bag has flown away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I removed my emo toque and started dabbing out my tears.
Yeah. Yeah. Welcome to MacGuffin Men. Today. If you were asleep for all of 1999, you don't know yet that we were talking about American Beauty.
Yeah. If you never saw any spoof movie between the years 2000 and 2003, we were talking about American Beauty.
Yeah. Made in 1999, directed by Sam Mendes, written by Alan Ball.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Baller.
Who our female vampire fans might know as the creator of True Blood.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 6 Feet Under and True Blood were the things he did.
Cool.
Yeah.
99 Best Picture.
Yep.
Winner.
Winner, yes.
Sam Mendes is like, I rule.
He bought a Pontiac Firebird. He shilled his trophy for Firebird money.
Yeah, so it's called American Beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And it won Best Picture.
It did.
And people look back on that win as maybe being undeserved now.
Okay.
Premiere came out with a list recently of the 20 most overrated films of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And American Beauty was pretty high up there.
Okay. I think it's totally fair to call American Beauty an overrated movie.
Okay.
I'd be curious to know what else is on that list.
Okay. Do you think it was always overrated, or do you think that people kind of turned on it as time passed and it didn't hold up?
I think it's a good movie. Okay. I think the third, the last quarter of the movie, basically once it starts raining, things get really sketchy.
Yeah.
Basically for the rest of the movie. I think up until that point, it's a really good movie.
Okay.
And I think, I guess not everything works in the movie, but the thing I do like and the thing I admire about the movie is it throws a lot of ideas at you. Some of it works, and it is sort of a movie where you can put as much into it as you want, or you can say, it is the most simplistic thing you've ever seen in your life, and it's terrible.
Yeah.
And that's a fault of the movie, that it's not strong enough with any of its points, but that's also kind of what I like about it. I like a movie that will let me come up with my own meaning for it.
Yeah.
I've been able to find different meanings in the movie, so, like, over the span of 10 years that right. I've been watching this movie.
I feel so negative and pessimistic in this session of podcast recordings.
Why?
Because I don't like this movie.
Okay.
And I didn't like Mystic River. And I worry that I just come off as elitist and that everything sucks and I know what's really good and other people. Like, I don't like when people always review movies through the lens of this is overrated, this is underrated.
Yeah, I don't like that at all.
Yeah, and I catch myself doing it more often than I'm happy with. I think it's a little like superiority thing. Like, I'm not going to judge this movie for how it is. I'm going to judge this movie that I know the real quality of as mm-hmm. compared to these other people. But I don't like this movie.
Okay, that's fine. Talking about points that we often make or, you know, things that come up often in the podcast, if I was a different age when this movie came out, I would like it less. But, I mean, there are things about this movie that I just really enjoy. And I used to watch it all the time in high school. Like, I've seen this movie a lot of times. I think it's a really funny movie. I think it's got two really funny performances in it. I don't think it, you know, it doesn't make me cry or anything.
Yeah.
But I think it's funny. I think Kevin Spacey's hilarious.
Yeah.
I think Annette Bening is funnier than I used to think she was.
Yeah.
Because she's really funny.
Yeah, you're supposed to hate her character, and you do.
I mean,
but watching it recently again, I totally must have missed how good she is in this movie.
Yeah, exactly.
I think she's very, very
good. I did, and I've seen this movie probably 15 times.
Yeah. I've seen this movie, I'm going to say 4 to 5 times.
Yeah, which is more than you've seen most movies.
Yeah, that's true.
Don't have
most
Batman
of those weren't by choice. Well, let's talk about what happens in this movie.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about our feelings on it.
Yep.
Then we'll talk about our feelings on each other, and then we'll just close out the podcast.
I don't think we're going to do the second last thing.
Okay. Okay. So
we all know that you generally annoy the shit out of me.
This has been established. This movie starts off with one thing I don't like in movies,
mm-hmm.
which is the "I'm dead now. Let's see what happened.
Yeah.
How do we get here?"
Yep.
It rarely works for me.
Okay.
Outside of "I know who killed me," I don't think anyone's ever executed it well, so...
And I mean, you're a bigger fan. Talk about overrated and underrated.
Yeah, really.
Like, you think the Lindsay Lohan filmography is just grossly underrated.
I do.
With the exception of Mean Girls, which you find totally overrated.
Disgusting.
Yeah.
It is the lowest point in the Lulography that will ever happen.
That's great. I love it.
Okay.
We're rolling. Let's keep it going.
Okay, so Lester Burnham, Kevin Spacey, is dead.
Oh, it's the suburbs, I'm dead.
How did we get here? And then he tells his story. Mm. And that is American Beauty.
Yeah, it's a year in the life of Lester Burnham. Yeah.
The last year.
The last year, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He lives in the suburbs.
He does.
With his wife, Annette Bening.
Yep.
And his daughter,
Thora Birch.
Of Monkey Dribble fame.
And a Limp Bizkit video.
Really?
Yeah. What? Later in her career, after she was faltering a little.
Was she? Which one?
I don't remember, but she's sitting like on a chair and Fred Durst is singing to her.
She would, though. Hmm. Let's talk about Monkey Dribble now. 16 million box office performance. Okay. Thora Birch is in this.
She is.
Playing who Thora Birch always plays once she turned 13.
Yeah. Teenage daughter.
But like the too much makeup.
Yep. Little more emotional than your average teenager.
Exactly.
She's really into Dashboard Confessional.
Yeah. It's also, we get Ricky Fitz.
Ricky Fitz, played by Wes Bentley.
Wes Bentley.
Tall, skinny Adam Scott.
Yes, absolutely.
Also,
his face is a little wider, though, or something. A
little bit, yeah. And he doesn't have, like, the coif on top of his head that Adam Scott always has.
The three-quarter Conan O'Brien, for some reason. Yeah. Adam Scott tends to rock inexplicably.
I have a question for you about Wes Bentley, because this is something
is it, where is he?
No, well, he was a junkie.
Yeah, he bottomed out.
Yeah, but he's going to be in the Hunger Games. Like, apparently he's all cleaned up. And have you seen the Hunger Games trailer? His facial hair is stellar.
Yeah?
Oh, my God. It's just, like, the most beautiful carved, like, pointy sideburns. You'll get a kick out of it.
Okay.
But anyways, this is something I was sort of arguing around 2000. Wes Bentley would have been a great Spider-Man, in my opinion. He was the guy I wanted to be Spider-Man.
Yeah.
When this was happening. And I don't know if maybe, because I think Spider-Man was 2002 or something, right? And so it makes sense that in 2000 I was arguing about the casting of Spider-Man. And he was sort of my
thought. I thought it was 2001.
It can't, because the Twin Towers ad, that would have gotten pulled after 9/11, right? And that was a teaser trailer, so it must have been 2002.
And it would have been the summer.
Yeah.
You're right. Point for Xander.
But yeah, no, I was just curious to know what you thought.
Yeah, no, I like it.
Okay.
And yeah, I was watching this, and I was like, he's not that he's amazing in this movie.
Nope, not at all.
But he just struck me as someone, I was like, you should have a bigger career.
Yeah.
And people liked this movie. And
you liked the Matador, he's in that. That's one of his I Need to Buy Heroin movies.
Who is he in Matador?
He's got a pretty small role, but he's an assistant of some kind, I think. I haven't seen that movie since it first came out. So. Huh.
Yeah. You should watch that again.
Yeah, no, I should, but...
You are Greg Kinnear.
I'm Greg Kinnear?
In my phone, you are.
Oh. Okay. You're James in my phone.
Yeah. James Marsden.
Yeah. Again. So there should be more jokes. Yeah, and Mina Suvari, I don't remember if we mentioned her, but that's pretty...
We didn't mention Mina Suvari.
Yeah.
I love her in this.
I think she's good. I think she's really good in the scene she has to be really good in, and I think she's really good in one other scene.
I think she's good in the scenes that you're probably not talking
okay,
about.
Fair enough. I think one of the scenes I'm talking about you agree with.
Yeah. No, that was the one thing when rewatching this movie, I was like, I totally did not give her or Annette Bening enough credit.
Yeah.
And I don't think...
It's because you hate women.
Yeah, I hate women.
Yeah,
Thora Birch didn't do much for me.
No, that's fine. She's
in any viewing.
Yeah.
Just that.
There to be the emotional child.
Put your shirt on. You're 16 years old. This is child pornography and I don't want to see it.
Yeah.
Mina Suvari.
Yes.
As a... What's her name? Chrissy Turlington.
Angela.
Angela.
Angela Hayes, I believe.
You know who else was offered the role?
No.
These are some great names.
Oh, Sarah Michelle Gellar was there, right?
SMG says no. Katie Holmes.
It's
not one of my great names.
Yeah.
Brittany Murphy.
Oh, yeah.
Who I love.
Yeah, you love Brimu.
She'd be great. But it went to Mina, and I think she does well.
Mm-hmm.
You total slut. that part cracks me up. I find it really good.
Yeah. Oh, one other actress we need to point out. The girl with the, like, bob hair that says, you were only in one issue of 17, and you looked fat, so stop acting like you're goddamn Chrissy Turlington. And then she does that amazing thing with her eyes that is so funny.
And her friend actually gets in on it silently,
yeah, yeah,
too.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, that... okay, we'll get to this, yep, about Mina and Kevin Spacey.
Yep.
But anyway, this is his midlife awakening, mm-hmm, instead of crisis.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, you know, nothing new. He's this person, he's married, he lives in the suburbs, his wife doesn't seem to care for him, he doesn't have a great relationship with his daughter, he hates his job, he masturbates in the shower, so he's sexually unhappy. Just nothing's going well for him, and... yeah, he's sad.
Yeah, basically.
That's where we start the film.
Yep. And yeah, we just sort of see how sad he is for a while and how basically pathetic this guy is. Like, there's so, like, few things that look more pathetic than Kevin Spacey putting his arms out to shrug and then his briefcase falling open.
Yeah. So many, like, things like that in the first 20 minutes.
Him napping in the back of the minivan. Like, oh my God. And like that he sits in the back seat. You know?
And then, yeah. So we've established that he's very sad. And then he starts his awakening. His making himself happy.
Yep. He smokes some weed and everything gets crazy for him.
Now, here's the thing about his awakening. Mm-hmm. He smokes some weed. He quits his job. He gets a new job. He buys the car he always wanted. He listens to music and works out.
And masturbates in his bed next to his wife. That's another key thing.
Yes. And this is all part of him, like, I'm going to start doing what I want. I'm going to be vocal about it. I'm not just going to take shit. You could say he's either regressing or becoming free and taking control of his life and finally enjoying himself and breaking out of this rut he's got himself in at his middle age. The thing that sets all of this off, though, is not the weed smoking, is not some... realization. It's his attraction to Mina Suvari's character.
Yep.
And I kind of forgot about that. I thought the order was a little bit mixed up. The first time we see anything about him wanting to change or this, you know, this whole new path he's going to take is when he goes to see his daughter's show, mm-hmm, his her little dance, cheerleading dance thing in between the basketball game at her high school. She'd not be on the dance team, but whatever, we'll look over that. Yeah. And that's what it is. That's what sets off. That is the catalyst, is him wanting to fuck the 17-year-old girl.
Yep.
And I don't like that.
No, that's fine. I guess I should make an argument that I think Kevin Spacey is hilarious in this movie, and getting to that dance sequence when he's, like, walking past people and he falls. So funny.
Everything, though, is just such a loser at the start.
Yeah, no, I know, but it's funny. It's that he kills it. Like, he's really funny. I love his performance. Lester Burnham isn't a good person. I don't think that at all.
No. He's not terrible. The worst thing is that, though.
Oh, that's definitely the worst thing.
And part of his awakening is he wants to get closer with his daughter and have a real relationship.
He's a really poor father. He never gets that.
No.
The closest he gets is, like, through a surrogate daughter.
Yes. That he's trying to sex with.
Yeah, and, like, he's a terrible father. Yeah. And, you know, he's not really a good person. Like, he doesn't do anything for others, you know? Like,
no.
So, yeah.
I mean, his heart seems to be in the right place. After his little awakening thing, he does seem to want to have a good relationship with his daughter and wife.
Yeah.
We don't see it that well.
I guess he makes an attempt with his wife in that he tries to have sex with her, but that's about it. And that's very much sort of,
yeah,
like,
but I mean,
thing.
Yeah, but he's like, oh, Janie, what happened to us? We used to be pals.
That's before his awakening.
Yeah.
He does sort of try there, but then she just turns it back on him, like, oh, I can talk to you? Like, now it's my fault?
Yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, no, Lester's not a good person. This isn't a movie filled with good people.
No, it's not. Mm. And let's talk about, I guess, the only other cast that we need to round this out would be two people I love, and I'm pretty sure you feel the same way about.
Three people. Peter Gallagher is another point. But, yeah,
Who's Peter Gallagher?
Bud. The king of real estate.
Oh, right, yeah. I know.
Peter Eyebrows Gallagher.
Peter, I'm not Eric Roberts Gallagher. That's all I see.
Yeah, Chris Cooper and Allison Janney, who play Ricky Fitz's parents.
So, Colonel Frank Fitz,
yeah,
United States Marine Corps.
And Allison Janney is mom. who's just the worst character.
She's so stupid.
It, oh,
even as a kid, I knew that character.
And Colonel Fitz is bad.
It's a very 1999 thing.
It is so over the top and bad. Okay, every bad person in this movie has a gun.
Yeah.
There's that.
Yeah.
It's a pretty clear indication. Let's go over what Mr. Fitz here is. He's supposed to be the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who stifles the ultra-artistically creative free spirit that is Ricky Fitz.
Yeah.
So
I don't know that he's artistic. He films things. He just sort of... He's more of a archivist than anything. He's a very sort of clinical type of person. He's an emotional person.
Okay, yeah, maybe not artistic, but emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And
just because he has a video camera doesn't mean he's artistic. You know what I mean? And he's shooting... He's filming things, but I don't think he's... doing these things for the art of it. I think he's filming these things so he can remember the beauty, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Well, at least he finds beauty in something.
Mm. No, he's definitely... obviously he's the most emotional person in the Fitz household.
Yeah. And in the film, pretty much.
Yeah.
And he's being stifled by his veteran father.
Although Lester makes a lot of emotional decisions, but it's a different kind of emotion than...
Yeah. And a lot of those are just primal instincts that get dressed up as emotional freedom.
Yeah.
But whatever. We might get to that later. Chris Cooper is apparently a Nazi sympathizer.
Yep.
He's
So that's a good sign that he's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's homophobic.
Yep. He's pointed out really quickly.
A repressed homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
Child beater.
Yep.
Not a very loving father.
Yep.
Yeah. These are all big indications that you're not supposed to like this dude.
Yeah.
And completely over the top.
Yep, totally over the top.
Okay. I just wanted to establish that.
Yep.
That, like, he's our bad guy and he just hits every mark. And I think you could drop the repressed homosexual thing from this.
Well, that's where it's really like, okay, come on.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, and that's what I said. The movie totally derails once it starts raining.
That is the end, yeah. Yeah, and why is Allison Janney in this movie?
I don't know. Like, it just—it's sort of like what this repression does to a person. That's what that is.
Yeah.
And 6 Feet Under, Alan Ball. What he basically the show he got after American Beauty is all about family and repression, and those are the things that are done possibly the worst in American Beauty, but are done really well in 6 Feet Under.
Okay.
And. Yeah, he's really big on those as themes. Like, I never watched True Blood, but so, I don't know if they're there. But
this is a very Alan Bali movie?
Yeah, and that's part of the reason... Like, the things I love about American Beauty, at least comedically, and the actual dramatic moments that I like, the technical elements that I like, are totally present in 6 Feet Under.
Okay. So. Now, is this a very Sam Mendes-y movie?
It's tricky, because Sam Mendes has a weird...
He's kind of all over the
place,
got
a weird
too, right?
career. Because I like American Beauty...
love Revolutionary Road.
I hated Revolutionary Road.
And this, again, I haven't seen Revolutionary Road.
It's terrible.
Yeah, no, I'm not gonna...
You should watch a Michael Shannon scene from that movie on YouTube and just picture him as the Joker. Because it's the same performance. Like, it was the same year, so it's not like he's copying it.
Yeah.
But I think you'd get a kick out of it. Because I whispered this to Emma when we were seeing the movie while Michael Shannon was performing.
Yeah.
It's like, picture Michael Shannon as the Joker. And she laughed instantly.
Well, no, here's my question about Revolutionary Road. Was that it seems like one of these, I'm stuck in the suburbs and I want to be more of a creative free spirit than this.
That's
and
true.
This uniformity and conformism is totally stifling that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just the thing with Revolutionary Road that was different is American Beauty has a lot more going on. I guess they're comparable in the suburb aspects, like the amount of things that work and that, you know, it's debatable. I think American Beauty is a better examination of the suburbs, if only because it's a suburb I recognize.
Yeah.
American Beauty is a far better film. Road to Perdition is a cool movie. I think that's, you know, generally a movie that not enough people saw. As far as an action movie, it's pretty great.
It looked really cool. I've never seen it.
Yeah, I would recommend it. You'd like it.
Jude Law.
Jude Law's fine in that movie. He's playing a very stylized character, so he can get away with it.
Okay.
Did you not see him in Gattaca? He's awesome in Gattaca.
I saw Gattaca, like, when it came out,
yeah,
and I don't count it.
We've been over this. You should see that movie again.
Yes.
It
was one of those ones that you could write about it, like, every year in MIT if you saw it.
Yeah.
And
I
did for some reason.
We'll do a podcast on it. I'll make you watch it again. Yeah, and Away We Go, I like a lot, but it's a very simple movie, and there's not a lot thematically there other than a couple. And it's just sort of, yeah. So, yeah, Sam Mendes has got an interesting career. Yeah, I don't know what a Sam Mendes film looks like.
Okay.
And next, now he's doing the new Bond movie. You know?
Okay. So unless there's some suburban dystopia in the next Bond movie, maybe it's not a theme.
The first official photo of Bond that was released, well, other than the one of him at the pool, but he's got stubble, so maybe suburbia is weighing on
him.
There
you go. This movie, we've kind of been talking about, it's, I mean, Lester's got a desire to kind of start getting satisfied sexually.
Yeah.
You know, through masturbation outside of the shower and by, you know, making some moves on his wife. And I understand what you said, that that is kind of a primal thing. Like, you know, he wants to have sex. That's not really a very selfless act. But it does seem to be in the context of building a bridge. Mm-hmm. Like, we'll start a physical thing and maybe that will, you know, lay the foundation. We can start being a couple. Because we get the idea that when they met, they were happy, that they weren't always like this. Like, it seems like it was a very slow, gradual thing for him. Near the end, when he kind of looks back on their life together, you see her do these crazy things. And
well, you just see her on an amusement park ride.
Yeah, no, but then there's the part where he's talking to her, and he's like, what happened to that girl I used to know?
That's
and
when he's leaning in when she's on the couch.
On the couch,
you're going to spill beer on the couch.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing with that that kind of bothers me, and it's something that bothers me about the movie, is that he's not necessarily going for a type of freedom as he is going for youth, a youth that's passed him by. Like, he's always talking about his
young
youth
things. Yeah.
Yeah, he's not necessarily going for what he really wants. He's going for what 19-year-old him wanted.
Yeah,
and I think that's something that's really problematic about the movie, is that, you know, it just kind of hates adulthood.
Yeah, and that's why I said
that, you know, like, as he's leaning in trying to have sex with her, he's like, what happened to that girl that would run up to the roof of and flash the helicopters? Like, yeah, these things that people, they did when they were young.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of what I said. It's, at the same time, it's kind of this, you know, he wants freedom, he wants to be himself, but it's also, ultimately, you can see it as a regression.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, exactly.
It's what are the two things that really set him off and allow him to kind of fulfill this fantasy? Wanting to have sex with his daughter's friend of the same age, which is weird.
And realizing this inside of a high school.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a good point. And Ricky Fitz, who's a high school age student, he kind of sees Ricky do all these things. Oh, how do you do that?
He smokes weed with Ricky.
Yeah, he smokes weed with Ricky, and then Ricky tells his boss off, and then you really see him start to idolize Ricky and wanting to, you know, he meets up with him and... Oh, by the way, that part where Chris Cooper sees him giving him the blowjob.
That's so goofy.
It's so goofy. Yeah. Yeah, did not like that part either. But yeah, I mean, it's all about youth. And he says the best time of his life was that summer where he worked at a fast food place to save up to buy an 8-track. All I did was smoke weed and get laid. Yeah.
Party and get laid, I think.
Yeah. Well, sorry. but it's not your definition of smoking weed. It's not partying.
Yeah, by the way, has anybody ever in real life asked, do you party, as a reference to do you smoke weed?
Absolutely.
Really?
It's, yeah.
Okay.
It's not a common thing anymore.
Is it a thing that an 18-year-old would have said in 1999?
I don't know.
Okay.
Because I wasn't Colin. Smoking weed when I was 12 years old.
Yeah. No, let's ask Colin if that was a thing that people said in 1999. Because yeah. I feel like he was around that age, right?
Party, man. Mm. No, I don't have a problem with that, actually.
Okay. I just think it's super goofy.
Yeah, and when Ricky's not being emo, I love Ricky Fitz.
Yep.
I think he's very awesome in this. But yeah, it's all about this regression. When you see something you like, it's always a young person doing it. And, you know, maybe you could say that they haven't had their soul sucked out or whatever, but it ties in with the bag thing mm-hmm. that we opened with, and that is absolutely the most iconic part of this movie.
Yeah.
Close second being some rose petals, but always the fucking bag for sure is the most iconic one.
Well, yeah, the thing that's great about the bag as far as the iconography is it can just sort of be there. Like, not another teen movie. He's just there with the bag.
Yeah.
Like the Ricky Fitz character. And it's just instantly, it's hilarious.
Yeah. You don't have to do the scene of him filming it. The bag just follows him. You're like, funny joke. Okay, what else is happening? Yeah, it ties in with the bag thing to me. He says that's the most beautiful thing he's ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And the bag is doing nothing. It really is just a passive object being acted upon. It's not about doing something or creating something. It's just about, you know, blowing in the wind, literally being just thrown around and just going with whatever comes.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like a kind of not a way that everybody could live at once and still be happy. And I think that's one of the big flaws of this movie for me, is that everything he wants to do and hopes for, it's, you can't live like that altogether.
Yep.
Like that, that I think that's the ultimate fallacy in this one. And same with, I've made this argument about Office Space too.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, the big thing is that he's happy. He's out of the office. And now he's working construction. And, you know, that was like kind of the ultimate freedom. But really, it's like, now you're making less money. Do you really think he's going to be happy as a construction worker in even 2 weeks? Like, there's this place where we get to a point where he thinks, okay, this is it. I'm happy now. This is really it. But the solutions aren't long lasting and they're not practical in any length of time. And to have a lot of people act this way is just, society wouldn't function. And that's kind of my problem with this movie. And I don't just dislike it on principle. And I'm not just saying I don't think that this is a sound message, therefore I can't enjoy anything about this movie. I do have other problems with this movie that makes me not like it. But I think it's just fetishizing in totally in the most sexual way at times, youth.
Yep.
And agreed. Irresponsibility at times and coasting like this bag, like him just, you know, he quits his job. And he works at a fast food place, and, oh, there's no stress. That's fine. But as his wife, who you're supposed to hate and totally demonize, is, you know, how are you going to pay for this house? How are you going to pay for your child's education? And it's just this regressive exceptionalism dressed up as artistic freedom, and it doesn't do much for me.
Yeah. I think it's just freedom. I don't know about artistic.
Yeah, no, artistic's not the right word.
Because, you know, he's working on the garage and listening to music. He's not creating music.
Yeah,
in the garage.
No, definitely artistic was the wrong choice of word. But it's this, like, I don't know.
Because that is something that feels like should be, you feel like there should be an artist character in this movie, but there isn't.
There's not. Yeah. Well,
and I get that feeling.
You know? Well, at the same time, Ricky Fitz, I feel that, and this sounds like a total dig on filmmakers and everything that totally isn't meant to be, and I do a movie podcast because I enjoy filmmakers.
Allegedly.
Yeah, you do a movie podcast. Not today, apparently.
You do a movie podcast so you have a microphone to say bad things about
shit,
films.
Oh, shit. Stupid. I hated that. Watch it again. I hate it. No, and I think this is something I was going to bring up anyway, is that the closest person we have to an artistic character is Ricky Fitz.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he's taking part in a very casual, lazy form of creating art. And I think that just turning on a camera and aiming it at something, you can call that art.
You can, but he never does.
No, that's fine. But I mean, like, that seems like to be the laziest way to make art. And, okay, as I said, I'm not saying that everyone who makes movies is lazy, and you can put a lot of work into a movie and it's not lazy at all. I get that, and I'm not trying to take that away from anybody. But it seems like he is a proxy for an artistic character, and he really doesn't do much to create. He just observes, and then he has this thing, and he has these walls and walls and shelves of tapes, and he feels like that's his and that he made that in a way, but it's very lazy. And I find that that's something that you see in, you know, Lester and a lot of characters in this movie, where it's just dressed up as this thing that's supposed to be more. And that's kind of how I think about this whole movie. And their tagline of "look closer" totally drives that home for me. It's like, look at this movie. And if you're looking at it, you got to look closer. You just don't get how deep this movie is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really nothing more. And when you say, you know, you can get into it as much as you put in, I think you can plug stuff into it. But I just don't think that there's very much in this movie. And it's just trying to be so much more than it is. And I totally think it fooled people. And that's why it got Best Picture. And it's pretentious, and I think it tries to be way more than it actually is able to pull off.
Okay, I disagree with you saying that Ricky is an artistic character, and you feel like he's an art. Like, it's never, the movie's never trying to make you feel like he's an artistic character. That's you putting that into it. Ricky is "look closer." That's what Ricky is, because that's what his tapes are. He's just observing. He's not doing anything. He's observing and he's filming, but he's never, like, we don't see him using, you know, any sort of editing software or anything. And, you know, his speech about the plastic bag is what totally sums up the movie. It's just this normal thing that you see, and you can find beauty in it. You can find beauty in the most everyday thing. And what is he doing when, You know, when Angela's dancing in front of the window and Thorbjerg is sitting in, or Janie is sitting in front of the mirror, he zooms past, you know, past Angela to see Janie. And in the cinematography of the movie, there's so much wide shots being done, and the idea, and it's a gorgeous movie visually. But it's shot so much wider than any movie like this has any right to be shot. And tries to cut down on close-ups whenever it can, and look closer is the thing that it's trying to get across. And, what Ricky absolutely isn't doing is, you know, is doing any of the easy work for you. He's just sort of capturing things that he saw as beautiful. And, you know, like it's everyday things. Like the most beautiful shots in this movie are totally everyday things. It's the symmetry in living room or the dining room table, or it's the red door being perfectly in the center of the shot while Kevin Spacey's walking down the pathway to the car or something.
Yeah.
I just totally disagree with you saying that Ricky Fitz is supposed to, he's more of a voyeur than any sort of artist. I do think that, I don't totally disagree with you saying this movie's overrated or that Look Closer is totally a pretentious tagline.
Yeah.
And okay. I'm not arguing that I totally disagree with your point. I do, however, totally disagree with the fact that Ricky Fitz is sort of a standard for some sort of artist character. I think he's the character that would seem most artistic to a viewer, but he's not an artist.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have someone working a camera in a film.
Yep.
You know, and but, I see what you mean. Like, that's totally, obviously the most easiest pick to who your artistic character is going to be. But let's take him and Janie, for example.
Mm-hmm.
His love for Janie, I don't think it's established very well.
Nope.
I think that the reason we're supposed to see her as sweet and emotional and caring and deep and spiritual and all these things is that she's not Angela. And we never build up Janie at all. We just put her next to Angela, and she's just such a great person in comparison to Angela, who, you know, sleeps with people to get on magazine covers and uses foul language and talks about all these inappropriate things, you know. And to me, that's kind of how a lot of the movie is. It's just comparing someone to just terrible, terrible people and making them look good without doing the work of establishing what makes them good or nice or sweet. And I just don't think this movie has much to say about people who are genuinely good people. And, you know, Ricky falls in love with her because she's not Angela. And I just don't think that there's much with that character.
No, I agree. And I mean, it goes back to my point that I don't think there are many good people in this movie.
Yeah.
And that sort of, that goes to the point that the movie's trying to make about suburban life. I mean, very basic point that suburban life isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah.
It's not the gorgeous, idyllic place that you think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. Everything about this movie is very broad.
Yeah. But I mean, Lester is a bad person. Yes. But Janie doesn't seem like a terrible person, but I still feel like we're meant to sympathize with her. And
we're meant to sympathize with her because her parents are awful.
But I think we're supposed to like her too.
Okay.
And I think that, what do we know about her? What do we have to like about this person?
Mm-hmm.
And it's nothing. They just give us someone who's worse than her, and, you know, we like her because she's the lesser of two evils.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it totally lines up with so much of what this movie says and what Lester's character is. It's just, I'm not these awful people. I can't say anything actually good or productive or, you know, say anything about this character that's really positive, but it's not all these negative things. And I think it's just a total blank. And this movie just sets up all these awful, over the top, awful characters like Colonel Fitz and all these just insanely, like it's a caricature of a bad person. And we like Lester and we like Janie because they're not these people. But you have a good point that Lester isn't really a good person.
No. Colonel Fitz, I think, is the most 1999 aspect of this movie in that.
See, I don't think it's a dated thing, though.
I think it is to an extent.
How so? Homophobia?
Well, this is just as gay characters are becoming a normal thing in television.
Okay.
Like where Will and Grace really kicks off you know, the, I mean, Ellen did in the mid 90s, but her show lasted less than a year after that, right? Yeah. After she came out. And it was, you know, it wasn't until sort of like Will and Grace, where you've got gay characters in primetime and this show succeeds. You can make an argument for the value of Will and Grace or lack thereof, but that they're gay characters present in primetime, a show about gay characters that succeeds, I think shows a step in culture. I think, yeah, and Will and Grace started a year before American Beauty. So, I mean, I feel like 1999 is the last year you could get away with a character like Colonel Fitz being widely accepted as not ridiculous. Although, I don't remember the general... Well, did Chris Cooper win an award for this? I think that's the sign.
That would decide it.
Because he did win for adaptation, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Then I think that was sort of... adaptation. Yeah. Then I think that was... That he probably didn't win for American Beauty then.
Yeah. But,
yeah. I think... I agree that Colonel Fitz is just an absurd character. I think it still works until it starts raining. I think he's still absurd, but until he beats his kid and tries to make it with Kevin Spacey, I think it still works as just sort of the terrifying army presence that you live with then. And, you know, like we said, subtlety is not this movie's thing.
So. Well, that's kind of heavy. Let's talk about the music in this one.
Good. I have a note capitalized about this.
Well,
all caps, I should say. And I handwrite my notes. This isn't a caps lock thing.
Well, I hold down shift when I do my capitals, so it's like
you're so into.
So I'm still trying pretty hard.
You're so Ricky Fitz.
What do you like about this music so much?
That
sounds kind of like the True Romance music.
I don't hear that.
The first song.
Okay, is this the piano theme? Oh, the do-do-do?
Yeah.
It's just sort of the instrument, right?
Maybe.
Yeah.
That's what I thought of right away. But anyway, go ahead.
I did just watch a movie where the music sounded so much like the True Romance movie. It might have been Haywire, the new Steven Soderbergh movie. Anyways, yeah. But yeah,
they digitally lower that girl's voice.
Yeah, I think it's fine. She sounds like a normal person in the movie.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a sweet movie. Yeah, I love the score in this movie. I know for a fact if you're telling me to pick a favorite movie score of all time, it's American Beauty.
Really?
Absolutely.
Ugh.
Yeah. I dig this movie. I dig the soundtrack so much.
I can tell.
Yeah.
You dig it the most, apparently. Yeah.
I don't, you know,
I'm not trying to change your mind.
There's plenty of goofy stuff, but, like the, you know, the music, the really, crazy music when he's getting root beer stuff, that's a sore point. But in general, I really like this
Rock?
Music. No, I like this better than The Rock. The Rock has a great, great theme. This movie has a couple good, really good themes.
News to me.
Yeah. Love the score.
Okay. Fine.
And you have something to say negatively about it.
I don't hate the score, but, sometimes before we podcast, we send some preliminary notes of things we should keep an eye on or things we might discuss. And you said you really enjoyed the score. I just wasn't crazy about it.
Okay. That's fine.
And I don't dislike it. It didn't detract from the movie for me. But I just throw it in with forgettable score.
The points I really like about the score, I like the intro. I like the beginning. I love that you know, there's sort of like three types of themes. There's that. There's the, you know, the crazier one where we're getting like all the cutbacks and the editing and stuff that I don't like that much. Like the root beer scene. One of the tracks is called Root Beer on the score.
What is this root beer thing?
Where he comes after he's gotten high, Angela, he comes back to the kitchen. He's looking for root beer and Angela comes in. And it's like when she touches his arm. And the piano theme, the plastic bag theme, which I like, and I like the sort of like wind in the background of it. I think that's a pretty great theme.
I'm fine with that.
And yeah, it's sort of split up into those three things.
And, you may like that song.
And yeah, and the piano theme towards the end actually too is really good with the it's different from the plastic bag theme, but as the movie's wrapping up, as he's sort of, you know, it's good. Thomas Newman has a penchant for making really corny scores, and aspects of the score are corny, but
this is a
great score. No, Thomas.
Gonna film a plastic bag. Make sure I got my toque on.
American Beauty the Musical, written by Randy Newman. It happen.
Here come some rose petals. I love Pontiac Firebirds.
my dad's an evil person. Hope you don't really. Oh, he's gay. You know.
Made some mac and cheese. Eat it off my Nazi plate.
What was the last part? I couldn't tell what you said.
His Nazi plate.
Oh, his Nazi plate.
Oh, good times. And then Alice and Janney's part.
Alice and Janney solo!
Basically best musical of all time.
Basically.
Yeah.
Do you want any smiley sauce?
That scene's funny. Come on.
And that girl.
Yeah, no, she's great.
Thanks for showing up.
Yeah. The part where Kevin Spacey, Lester says, but I bet you're going to remember me this time.
Yeah, that's a check mark.
Okay, let's talk about the aspects of this movie that you do like, because you have to have laughed in this movie.
Yeah, no, I did. I really like Kevin Spacey. I really like Annette Bening. I really like Mina Suvari. Okay. I do love non-emo Ricky Fitz. Honestly, yep. Him saying "Do you party?" I really like.
Okay.
Him quitting to that dude calling him an asshole.
Yeah,
that's a win to me.
That's a good scene. I like that scene a lot.
Yeah, that scene, and then
all of that scene.
And when she comes out, and then he goes, I do even though I don't like a lot of the.
You like that John Cho is in it also.
Yeah, I did like that John Cho is in it as sales house person number two.
Yeah.
Yes, that is his exact title.
Another thing that's super broad about this movie is that that house that Annette Bening is trying to sell is so old. Like, it's like the Donnie Darko house. Every room in that house is in Donnie Darko, and Donnie Darko took place in the 80s, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I really like, actually, I liked it less this time than I remember, but I still enjoy his little death speech.
Okay. Which is...
When he's like, they say when you die that your whole life flashes in front of your eyes, but it doesn't, not a second, it seems like an entire lifetime. I remember this and this and this. Like, that part still gets me. And even though I don't really like this movie that much, that part still gets me a little bit.
That's another reason why this movie was, I think, was so well liked, is because as crazy as it gets in that third act, I think it comes together.
Yeah, and when you leave on that note, and that's what people have fresh in their minds when it ends, absolutely, I agree with that. The Janey part, when they opens the door and you see her younger and younger, that part totally works for me. Yeah, as I said, even though I don't like a lot of the, ideas that are coming through his little breakout thing and his finding himself or whatever it is, there's so many parts of that work. Kevin Spacey altogether is just great in this movie.
Oh, he's hilarious.
But so much of him, like, I'm going to wail on my pecs and then do my back. Wail on my pecs, total winner. I laughed out loud watching this by myself sometime, the last time I watched it. Some parts just don't hit it for me, and then some parts are right on the money, in my opinion.
And this is something I mentioned about Kevin Spacey in our podcast on David Fincher. Kevin Spacey has such like a unique voice. He's got such an old school voice. And by old school, I mean like the 30s old
school.
Bobby
Darin?
No, let's not talk about Beyond the Sea. That is one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life. But he's got sort of like almost a Carnival Barker type voice.
Yeah.
Whenever he yells like, turn off the lights when you come back to bed. You know, it's like he sounds like Liz Lemon impersonating somebody from the, like, you know? And I think it works so well whenever he's being over the top in this movie. And, you know, there's so many little things like him falling in the gym as they're on their way to their seat, or when he buys his Firebird and he's just driving the remote control car and cracks it into Benning's ankles. And him laughing at that is so funny. And then, of course, him talking about the Pontiac Firebird and how he rules. Also great.
Yeah. Also good.
But yeah, there's just so much in this movie that I think he's just really funny.
Yeah, and him at the, when he meets the real estate king again.
Yeah.
And he's supposed to just be a total wiener.
Yeah.
That part's good.
Yep.
There are plenty of things I like.
My point about American Beauty is I'm not letting you get away with saying this movie isn't funny.
That's fine. And this movie isn't totally awful.
Yeah.
And if I had to watch it again, I wouldn't be mad, but there's tons of things I'd rather watch. You said this is a very 1999 movie?
No, I said aspects of it.
Okay.
The Colonel Fitz stuff.
Colonel Fitz.
Really over the top. It's sort of like the last time you could get away with this.
Okay. This came out around the same time as Fight Club.
Yeah.
See any similarities there? Are movies like this the kind of adult, you know, breaking out of the slow drab world, whether it be the workplace or whether it be suburbs or a bad relationship or all of them combined. Is that just something that we get all the time, or is there something about 99 that made it particularly pertinent?
Well, I think, because there were other movies around this time that I can't remember off the top of my head, but that were sort of the same thing. And it's just sort of, you know, it's been 10 years since the 80s. The 80s is sort of coming into focus. And the 80s was a pretty, as far as like commercial aspects go, it was a pretty crazy decade. Yeah. From what I know, you know, like wasn't aware of the 80s. I was alive for 4 years of it, but, you know. Yeah, and I think it's sort of, film particularly is always on a delay. Like, because it takes so long to get a film made. But I mean, yeah, I think it's when...
And for it to sink in and write.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think the 80s, you know, around 99, this is where the 80s start to come into focus. Or I guess around 97, when you're starting to put these movies together.
Yeah.
Is when the 80s sort of starts to come into focus. And what's the thing you take away from the 80s? I always picture Gordon Gekko and that type of thing. And yuppies and stuff like that. And
yeah.
Yuppies grow up into Lester Burnham and Carol.
Yeah.
That's her name, right? Carol?
I don't know. I've called her Annette Bening every time, but I think it is Carol.
I think I've gone back and forth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have, as I said, a lot of this is about regression, and a lot of like, it's him trying to get his teenage years back, which gives us the 70s and 60s. Mm-hmm. The music that he chooses to listen to, I mean, when he's in his garage and he's working out or smoking weed, he's listening to Dylan, and he's very happy when he sees Ricky Fitz's Pink Floyd album. I mean, these are things that, just because of his age, that's going to be what was important to him when he was young. But at the same time, historically speaking, the 60s and 70s were a much different time from the 80s. Mm-hmm. Even if you were 19 years old in 1985, that's still a different time, you know, musically, culturally, and everything. So, you know, it does work out in this timeline that he doesn't love 80s music because that wasn't when he was young and you developed, your taste for music like that. But just something about 60s and 70s popular music was much more about, you know, freedom and free love and, you know, spiritualism and, you know, these kinds of things, which are themes in the movie. So, you know, that's part of it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my anti-80s point is more not so much Lester's choices as the films, in that what the movie is about as far as the suburban life is to avoid this commercial stuff. And it's sort of what you were getting at too, but yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Lester isn't running away from the 80s. He's running away from the 90s.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, as I said, it is very coincidental that this would be the music that he was growing up with. Mm-hmm. But, for example, it's not the music Ricky Fitz grew up with, but that still seems like, you know, that's the music he has.
Yeah.
Is the 60s and 70s were a time where all these things were supposedly, you know, popular and the right thing to do. And that's what the characters who are supposed to be the free, youthful, spiritual, you know, nonconformist people.
Mm-hmm.
These are the generations we see them attached to, you know, whether it's his car, the 70s Firebird, Ricky's taste in music, his taste in music, all these things are skipping over the historically greed decade of the 80s. You know, it wouldn't make sense if he started putting on like Devo or whatever listen to in the 80s, but it certainly is a time and place.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess
I'm just an ordinary guy with nothing to lose. That is actually a line of dialogue in this movie, and I hate it.
A line of dialogue that I hate in this movie is Janie saying to Ricky, "Are you afraid or whatever? Or are you scared?" And he's like, "Nothing scares me." Like, that's so funny, but not in an intended way.
Yeah.
One other thing that's really funny that we haven't mentioned is the dance sequence. How much Janie screws up. I think that's so funny.
Kicks her hat away.
Oh, God. I think that's so funny.
Did you choreograph that dance?
Paul Abdul.
That's right.
Yeah.
Speaking of the 80s.
But I guess American Beauty is about repression, regression, and, you know, look closer to find beauty in the world. You know, I think of those three, it gets the most broad one, which is look closer. The best, you know, I think that's the one it gets across the best and in the least problematic way because it's a super broad point.
It's super broad, but still undeserved, even for a broad statement or message. I just feel like I've seen this movie many times, and I've tried to look closer every time, mm-hmm. and I just feel like it dresses up as something much deeper than it really okay. is.
Yeah, I'm still, you know, I still like this movie. I still think it's really funny. You know, the last half hour doesn't work, if only for the fact that it allowed Alan Ball to make Six Feet Under, which again has really sketchy moments all throughout its run, but does some things extraordinarily well, particularly the first season, which is pretty awesome in general. If only to allow Six Feet Under to exist, I'm happy American Beauty succeeded as it did. And I think it's a gorgeous movie. I think the score is great. I think technically this movie is pretty awesome. I'm happy we disagree. I like when we disagree. We don't disagree about enough things.
Not now.
But yeah, it's good to argue every once in a while.
It is good when
to prove that we are not the same person.
It is good when you're empirically wrong about a movie and I get to argue against it. And I'm, you know, just being devil's avocado, I probably came off more negative about this movie, but yeah. We are certain that you're a bigger fan than I am.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And that's fine.
Yep. And again, you're fighting against the critical reception of this movie. As okay. well, because that's how you do things. So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Men, and be sure to check back next week. Thanks again.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by Katherine Heigl's Scriptreader. I swear to God, I exist. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.